The Debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. A joint statement by EU and UK says that following intensive work, the two sides can now announce their agreement in principle on all issues with regard to the protocol on the two islands. After lots of 10 months, differences still remain on governance, fisheries and standards. The UK is speaking of removing some controversial clauses from the internal market bill, while the EU has negated any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Are the two sides going to remove the remaining obstacles to a deal on future trade ties within the limited time left? Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Let's first go to our London bureau, Said Pourreza is there. Said, tell us about the London side of this prolonged, process of discussions and talks.
The agreement today will be removing the controversial clauses out of the internal markets bill caused uproar not only in European capitals but also in the U.S. It is being received as welcome news, but is it being treated as a breakthrough in the trade talks? Probably not. The honest answer to where these negotiations stand, the trade deal between the UK and the EU, is that really no one knows which way these negotiations are going to go. Both sides have painted a gloomy picture of it all. Number 10 saying today that the chances of a deal are not very good. As a matter of fact, most recently the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, and I quote, "You have to be optimistic, you have to believe in the power of sweet reason to get this thing over the line, but it's looking very, very difficult at the moment. The key thing," he said, "is that whatever happens on January 1st, that's the day after the December 31st deadline, things are going to change and people ought to get ready for that change." On the European side, the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, who has been very optimistic all along and has kept things smooth, has been quoted as saying today in a meeting with heads of states that the chances of reaching an agreement with the UK are now very slim. So as you can see, very gloomy on both sides, both parties to these negotiations. Realistically, the only people who know the answer to what will happen next are two people: the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who will be meeting at some point this week. And of course, this comes after a lengthy phone call between the two of them. I think it was yesterday or the day before, that really didn't break the impasse in the negotiations. As you said earlier, what we need to look at, again, is what's happening on the edges of these negotiations. Perhaps look at the internal politics in the UK, the agreement today between the Cabinet Office Minister, Michael Gove, and his European counterparts vis-a-vis the internal market bill. Perhaps that might send a signal that the UK is willing to compromise, because so far the two sides have been very recalcitrant, if you will, in their positions, the UK not really budging over fisheries and those two other issues, such as the level playing field or the state subsidies to businesses, as well as the issue of governance. Those three stumbling blocks still remain in the way of a trade talk. So the UK position seems to be just the same as the EU's. Both sides seem to want a deal, but at the same time, they're not really ready to make any compromises on their positions. And as I say, both sides saying that the chances of a deal don't look very, very good at this moment.
Okay, appreciate that, Said Pourreza, London Bureau. Now, joining me in this debate first will be Director of the Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart. Stuart is joining us out of London. Good to have you with us, sir. UK Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove has expressed delight over reaching an agreement on post-Brexit arrangements for the Irish border. Is this a breakthrough that could facilitate the trade deal eventually?
Your commentator from London was absolutely right. No, it wasn't really a breakthrough. Frankly, this was almost a rather strange, well, it was a very strange action taken by the government previously on this. And in many ways, it was almost set up to try and actually almost annoy the EU in their negotiations, and then to be able to give away on it later in time, to be able to say, well, actually, we've now given something back to you. It's a negotiating ploy. Actually, I don't think that really worked. It just served only to annoy absolutely everybody, and especially the Irish, and also, of course, the Americans as well. And this came up during the presidential election. So I'm afraid, as your commentator said, we're still waiting to see whether there's going to be a final agreement. But as often with European affairs, it's often right at the last minute that something may well be pulled out of the bag.
Well, Justin, the Johnson administration has announced that it will remove law-breaking clauses from the internal market bill. That's been a source of concern for the EU. Would that go through Westminster, you think?
Yes, it would go through. That would actually be approved because there was a lot of anger, actually, because of it was seen as really the United Kingdom going against international law, being seen to breach an international agreement that it had with the EU. And that would be very bad in terms of reputation. Obviously, that sort of reputation when you're doing international deals. Well, as having people going back on their word, no, not their word, on a signed treaty, I'm afraid would be seen as a very bad precedent indeed. And frankly, I think an awful lot of the politicians were seriously embarrassed. This is not the sort of thing you would expect from the United Kingdom government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, also joining us on this debate show will be journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tweedy, out of Plymouth. Good to have you with us, James. Let's have your opinion on this agreement that Michael Gove talked about, and if you think that this could kind of help facilitate the future trade relations and clinching a deal on that front.
Well, what this seems to do is tidy up the withdrawal agreement that was agreed back in 2019, more than a year ago, about a year ago. And it deals with certain disputes that have arisen around Northern Ireland and, you know, the provisions on Northern Ireland. And so that seems to tidy that up. And that, you know, at the very least says that the withdrawal agreement, the original withdrawal agreement, will be maintained. Neither side is going to break it, and neither side is going to pull out of it because the other side has broken some of the provisions on it. So, okay, that's one thing. It doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a deal because everything I'm reading about this right now says that the EU is still asking for the same things it was 6 months or a year ago, that Britain must continue to abide by rules that it makes, including new rules that it makes. You know, we've already left the EU, but from now on, and that European fishermen should have, almost the same level of access to British fishing waters for a very long period of time, at least 10 years. So that's not going to fly necessarily unless the British government decides to cave in on those issues, which everything they're saying is that they're not going to do that. So, okay, they've said many times they're not going to do that. If they do, then it discredits them. So, it's hard to see where this is going to go. I mean, there are sources who say that actually Michel Barnier is the one who's responsible for this, along with the French government. He was self-isolating for a few days after one of his team tested positive for COVID-19. He couldn't really play much part in the negotiations, even virtually. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU Commission, took over and started to make some concessions, because I think what the Germans, she's German, right? What the Germans want is they want to be able to sell motor cars and other heavy industrial goods in Britain without tariffs. What the French want, well, okay, they make a lot of cars and things too that they export to us, but you know, the kind of lobby of the farmers and the fishermen there is politically more powerful perhaps, and they want to maintain this kind of, you know, they want to keep having that access to our fisheries.
Okay, back to London. Justin, Boris Johnson hopes, I'm quoting him, the power of sweet reason will allow the UK and EU to reach a post-Brexit trade deal this week. Are you optimistic this is going to happen?
Well, I was optimistic the past few days, but maybe more pessimistic. I'll put it this way, it would be incredibly stupid for the British government not to have a deal. Brexit in its own right is already going to make the country, the economy, smaller anyway over the next few years. And by not having a trade deal, that's going to make it even worse. Now, it's going to actually impact not just on confidence within the United Kingdom itself, but also inward investment confidence. And, of course, one of the key areas that has been ignored on this, really, has been the Japanese car plants, where they assemble Japanese cars in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom was very willing to accept these to be developed. And the deal, particularly with Nissan, was really they saw Britain, the United Kingdom, as a gateway to Europe, not as a destination. And so therefore, when the threat of Brexit came up, Nissan made it abundantly clear that unless we have exactly the same position we're in now, then the next round of investment in the next series of cars will be going to Barcelona in Spain and not to Sunderland in Northern England. So it remains to be seen that if they don't get that, we don't get that deal coming through, whether the Japanese follow through on that, and although they have said they would invest in Sunderland, actually, we also know that there's a backup. They may well reverse that decision. So for Boris Johnson, despite his own political problems with inside his party, with a lot of Brexiteers in there, actually, economically, it will be very difficult and very dangerous for this economy, especially with regard to the key elements of our financial areas, which is actually the City of London and financial services, which earns a huge amount of money for the UK economy. Whereas, of course, actually fishing, which is very emotional to many people, with people going out and actually risking their lives fishing and such like, but economically is almost irrelevant to the British economy. And so, therefore, they must get a deal. And frankly, the fishermen should not be getting in the way of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, James, Michel Barnier has stressed on his Twitter page that, quote, access to our market comes with conditions. What conditions is he alluding to?
Well, he's talking about this regulatory alignment where we have to follow the same rules as the EU that they set, but we don't have a say in, and that we shouldn't, and part of some of those rules include that we are not allowed to give any kind of state aid to industry, you know, which could be defined by a judge. So it could be, you know, almost anything. It could be like the government giving contracts to one company and not another, perhaps. But you know, certainly it would prevent, you know, it did not prevent the great banking bailout during the credit crunch. It didn't make any objections to that. But it has in the past prevented the British government from saving steel makers in this country, which is quite an important industry, or it used to be. It still is significant in this country. So then we have Bombardier, there's a company which is based in Canada but has operations in Northern Ireland. That has been accused of, the EU has been accused of giving state aid to that, to Bombardier by the US. And then the EU has also accused the US of giving state aid to Boeing, see? So now Bombardier is going to be our responsibility. They make passenger jets. So if we keep, subsidising them to produce those jets in Northern Ireland, which has got quite a depressed economy, then maybe the EU will say, no, that's not good, can't do that. So this kind of thing. So actually any kind of what you might call a progressive social democratic policy is actually kind of banned by the EU, lots of those kind of policies are banned by the EU because the government can't intervene in the economy, you see? So these are the problems. I mean, another thing I'm going to say is that, you can't have access to your market unless you follow our rules. Well, okay, the people who voted to leave never actually felt any great benefit from the EU, and actually they felt that they've actually lost things, like many people lost their jobs, because we used to have a much larger car making industry in this country, and after we joined the EU, a lot of it was shipped to Eastern Europe. The factories moved to Eastern Europe, production of companies like Ford, which was exclusively in Britain in the east of London, moved to Eastern Europe. So, you know, we've lost out because of free trade. So actually, losing free trade with Europe isn't such a bad thing. We trade more with the rest of the world than we do with the EU now, and trade with the rest of the world is growing 10 times faster than trade with the EU. It has been for the last decade. So, you know, the trends are that Europe is not so important. I say Europe, I mean, the European Union, which doesn't include the two most important countries in Europe, which are Russia and the UK, is not that important to us anymore, and is becoming less and less important, and the rest of the world is more important.
Now, Justin, the two sides still disagree on issues like fishing rights, business competition rules, and the manner of their implementation. Do you know of any solutions to those issues?
Yes, the fishing rights could actually be put to one side and be dealt with separately, because previously this was already managed by way of licenses which had been issued to various countries and to the fishing industry in those countries. And in fact, the United Kingdom's fishing industry has actually sold their licenses. So this is an issue which has already been dealt with separately, and frankly is getting in the way of this particular element. And the problem is it's become a very emotional subject, which of course the media has picked up on. And of course, it's always very emotional with sailors going out and catching these fish. But as I said before, it's not actually that important. In terms of subsidies overall, it's fascinating because, of course, one government's investment is another country's subsidy. Europe's been having subsidies or investments for years doing this. So it's a matter of interpretation. Now, what the EU wants to make sure is there isn't going to be any unfair bias in terms of supporting industries, and I suppose that's only going to be to be expected. But you know, Britain does need to be part of the trading unit. As James was just saying, trade elsewhere around the world has been growing, but Britain's largest trading partner in the world is the EU, the largest trading bloc in the world, and in terms of actually the value to us of that, it's very important. But also, don't underestimate the amount of value that actually the UK is to certainly countries like Germany and the exports of their cars coming through. But really one of the key elements have been some of the infrastructure which is so vital in Europe, certainly in terms of scientific infrastructure, investment infrastructure and things like that, which Britain will now be missing out on and has already been losing out in terms of some of the jobs and future investment. So any particular deal wouldn't necessarily reverse any of that process, but it still makes sure that the United Kingdom has access to the free market. If you don't have access to that, you immediately start seeing tariff rises, and the operational structure of moving elements without barriers across the not just the English Channel, but also across the Irish borders as well, will cause operational difficulties. And that's an unnecessary cost, which the United Kingdom does not need.
Okay. Now, James, we have 1 minute only, and this is the last question. Johnson has spoken of difficult talks, but promised there are great options ahead of his country on any view. What is he talking about?
Well, he's being optimistic. He's saying that Britain will, as he's said for years now, that Britain will thrive when it's outside the EU. It will, you know, it has opportunities. Certainly, Britain can, as being independent of the EU, can sign trade deals with other countries, which it already has done, and it doesn't have to wait for the EU's approval on that. Staying within the EU customs union would have prevented us from doing that, for instance. So, okay, there's that. And I suppose he is still, you know, he's still saying he's optimistic of making a deal, even though essentially all progress has been set back to square one. But there it is. What else can I say? I'd just like to answer something that Mr. Stewart said. You know, I should stress that Britain has far higher standards than most European countries when it comes to things like labour standards, food standards, consumer standards, health standards.
Okay.
We're one of the countries with the highest minimum wage. That's why That's why British manufacturing jobs have been offshored into Eastern Europe, for instance.
Okay, we're out of time. Sorry, I got to jump in. That's all
we're
the time
out of time.
We have.
Okay,
I'm
thanks
sorry.
Very much.
Okay, let me thank our guests. We have Director of Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, who joined us from London, and journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tudy, out of Plymouth.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij in his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Sheikh Tawheed, is it permissible according to the fatwa or religious Islamic law concerning the permissibility of, let's say, or impermissibility of selling alcoholic drinks, pork, or other stuff whose consumption is considered haram to the Muslims, in fact, or even, you know, is it permissible to give them as a gift to a non-Muslim?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible to sell or to give as a gift anything like alcoholic drinks or pork or haram food stuff. And this is very general, you know.
Yes.
When we say haram food stuff, it could be in the form of meat, it could be in the form of intoxicants.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there is a food, there is a special food with a large quantity of alcohol in it.
Yes.
Because some foodstuffs contain alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore selling these items, these things, and gifting them to someone like a non-Muslim, let alone a Muslim,
yes,
is not permissible according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And therefore, it's not permissible to do anything associated with these things, even to do anything, to work, to process, and to sell, to transport, to deliver, because there are a lot of delivery jobs also.
Yes.
in Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
There are delivery companies.
Yes.
And those delivery companies are responsible to deliver these items to the gate of the clients' houses. Okay.
Yes.
Some Muslims might be working for these delivery companies
in that area.
Yes. If a person knows that what he's going to deliver is a bottle of wine or a pack, let's say a package or containing meat, haram pork, pork, of course, it's not permissible for him to deliver it. And the money which comes for delivering it, because he might spend 1 hour delivering it, the money that he receives for that 1 hour is haram.
Mm-hmm. What if it's a mixed bag?
What do you mean?
It's a mixed bag.
The
driver doesn't know it might include or not.
Oh, that's something else. That's a different scenario.
Uh-huh.
As long as you do not know that what you are carrying could contain haram meat, it is permissible. Because you have no knowledge. As long as you have no knowledge, you are not responsible
of the parcel, yes, of the package,
of the package, or whatever
you
that you are transporting. Yes, you are not responsible for what you do not know. It's not necessary to investigate.
Uh-huh.
To investigate, and you will hand it over to the people, to the recipient, and come back. Okay, you are not sure about it. So it's permissible. Yeah, the money that you receive is it's halal. Just as, like, for example, imagine your cloth is impure, ritually impure.
Yes.
You offer your prayers with the impure clothes, not knowing that your cloth is stained with blood.
Yes.
Okay, or there's something najasa.
Yes.
On your clothes. You offer your prayers, and after a while, let's say after 1 day or 2 days, you realize, or you come to know that your cloth was impure.
Mm-hmm.
The prayer that you have offered with that impure cloth is valid.
I see.
Because you, at that time, you were certain that your cloth was pure.
Mm-hmm.
The same is the case with things which you deliver, which you take to the clients' houses, and you are not responsible. You don't need to investigate what you are transporting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Sheikh Javid, is it also permissible to run a hotel or to work in that area of service in a European country, for example, concerning the fact that you will serve the clients with pork and alcohol in the hotel, of course?
There is no doubt as to the fact that serving the clients with pork and alcohol is not permissible according to all religious authorities. Even if those clients are non-Muslims who consume such things on a daily basis, okay? But we as Muslims cannot sell these things. We cannot sell wine, we cannot sell alcohol, and we cannot sell pork to those clients. Therefore, it's necessary for an individual who is looking for a job to make sure that his job does not have anything to do with these things, okay? He can tell the hotel owner. If he himself is the owner, he should make sure that he will not sell these things, these items to the clients.
Yes.
And if he is just a worker working for that hotel or restaurant, he should tell the hotel owner or to his boss that he will not do any of these things. He will not serve the clients with alcohol or pork or haram meat.
I see. Yes. Okay. What about this scenario, which is somehow different from the previous question? What is the religious rule on some type of scaled fish which dies inside the fishing nets? We all know that this happens a lot, like when the ships sail, they set out to the sea to fish, and they come back with a lot of fish, but they use a special type of fishing method, and then their fishing net is so large, and sometimes they carry it even in the water before reaching the shore or before transporting it to the shore. And what if some of these scaled fish, I'm talking about the scaled fish, of course.
Yes, of course.
The fish without the scales are haram in and of themselves, right? But what if these scaled fish die before coming to the shore, before, in fact, getting out and dying on the land?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei has stated clearly that there is no problem if a fish dies in a fishing net, okay?
Yes.
This generally happens, but the consumers cannot ascertain. It is not within their means, or it's not possible for them to ascertain that the fish has died in a fishing net or not, because the fish are hunted on a large scale.
Yes.
The fishing net is so big, and it's not difficult, it's not possible to ascertain whether a certain fish has died in the fishing net or out on the deck, okay? And therefore, even if a fish is supposedly dies in a fishing net, Ayatollah Khamenei says that it is still permissible to consume, to eat that fish, provided that, as you rightly mentioned, it is a scaled fish.
Mm-hmm.
It is from the category of a scaled fish, because some fish do not apparently have the scales.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
But they are from the category of the scaled fish, you know. It is important that the fish comes from that category, from the halal category. And if that is from that halal, if a fish is from the halal category, even if it does not have, apparently if it does not have the scales, it
you mean their scales are not realizable through naked eyes?
Yeah, of course. But it is from the scaled fish, from the category of the scaled fish. It is permissible to consume that fish and to use it, yes, and to sell it, and of course eat it.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم فلا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The incongruous approaches and the lack of national standards in the U.S. have created confusion, conflict, and a muddled public health message, likely hampering efforts to stop the spread of coronavirus, says David Armstrong, writer, in an article published under the heading, American States with Lax COVID-19 Restrictions are spreading the virus to their neighbors. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As the number of COVID-19 cases skyrockets across the U.S., the extent of the public health response varies from one state and sometimes one town to the next. The incongruous approaches and the lack of national standards in the U.S. have created confusion, conflict, and a muddled public health message, likely hampering efforts to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Nowhere are these regulatory disparities more counterproductive and jarring than in the border areas between restrictive and permissive states. For example, between Washington and Idaho, Minnesota and South Dakota, and Illinois and Iowa. In each pairing, one state has imposed tough and sometimes unpopular restrictions on behavior, only to be confounded by a neighbor's leniency. Like factories whose emissions boost asthma rates for miles around, a state's lax public health policies can wreak damage beyond its borders. motorcycle rally in August in Sturgis, South Dakota, with 500,000 attendees from around the country, spread COVID-19 to neighboring Minnesota and beyond. According to Melanie Firestone, an Epidemic Intelligence Service officer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who co-authored a report on the event's impact. South Dakota didn't have policies regarding mask use or even size, and we see that there was an impact in a state that did have such policies, Firestone said. The findings from this outbreak support having consistent approaches across the states. We are all in it together when it comes to stopping the spread of COVID-19. Viruses don't respect geographic boundaries. While some states require visitors, especially from high-risk areas, to be tested or quarantined, others, like South Dakota, have no such restrictions. Many people who are tired of strict COVID-19 measures in their states have escaped to areas where everyday life more closely resembles pre-pandemic times. There, with fewer protections, they are at risk of contracting the virus and bringing it back home. After the Idaho concert, Gilliard started feeling ill and was diagnosed with the coronavirus. For about a week, he stayed in bed. As his condition worsened, he was admitted to a Spokane hospital and placed on a ventilator. He died on October 15. His death certificate lists COVID-19 as the underlying cause. Going to the Idaho festival likely killed Gillard, his ex-wife, Robin Ball, said. If he had been wearing a mask, not shaking hands, and keeping distance, he would probably be alive, she said. He had been careful before that. He shouldn't have been up there. The degree of coronavirus regulation tends to track political lines. Trump has helped to fuel the patchwork response to the pandemic, criticizing the approaches of some states, praising others, and at times contradicting the advice of his own coronavirus task force. A lack of such consistency is affecting Eastern Washington, which appears to be absorbing some of the cost, both human and economic, of Idaho's more laissez-faire approach to the virus. The rate of new cases in and around Spokane near the Idaho border is far higher than in Seattle and Western Washington, which experienced one of the earliest outbreaks in the U.S. in February. Although slightly more than half of recent COVID-19 cases in Spokane spread among the households or personal contacts, Spokane Regional Health District Epidemiologist Mark Springer said, people bringing back COVID-19 from larger events in Idaho has been a problem. And with Idaho's rate of new cases now doubling Washington's, Idahoans who commute to the Spokane area pose an outsized danger. At the same time, Washington's shuttered businesses have ceded customers to their Idaho competitors. Public schools in Washington have also suffered. After opening the school year with remote-only instruction, the Newport School District lost about one-fourth of its 1,200 students. South Dakota has largely remained open for business during the pandemic. Governor Kristi Noem, an ally of Trump's, has refused to impose a mask mandate, saying there are questions about its effectiveness. The state has not placed any restrictions on restaurants, and officials allowed the 10-day motorcycle rally in Sturgis. Such a rally would have been prohibited in Minnesota. Both Minnesota and South Dakota are in the top five states when it comes to rates of cases per capita over the last week. The CDC advises that outdoor events are less risky than indoor ones. The Sturgis rally, which featured events in both settings, is now linked to at least 86 COVID-19 cases in Minnesota, including four people who were hospitalized and one death, according to a CDC report released in November. The report said the total is likely an undercount, as some of those infected declined to share their close contacts with health officials. These findings highlight the far-reaching effects that gatherings in one area might have on another area, the researchers wrote. They added, this rally not only had a direct impact on the health of attendees, but also led to subsequent SARS-CoV-2 transmission among household, social, and workplace contacts of rally attendees upon their return to Minnesota. Mike Call, the mayor of Worthington, Minnesota, said, South Dakota's approach to the pandemic is a source of heartburn for me and sleepless nights. His city is close to both the South Dakota and Iowa borders. In addition to worries about the virus spreading from South Dakota, Call said, during the lockdown, people have gone to Sioux Falls for shopping. It's ugly for us businesses. A similar dynamic has played out in the Quad Cities area at the border of Illinois and Iowa. There, thousands of people cross bridges over the Mississippi River every day to work, visit family, and shop in each state. As cases in Iowa began to surge this summer, Governor Kim Reynolds dismissed mask mandates as feel-good measures that are difficult to enforce. Until recently, Iowa restaurants and gyms were allowed to operate at full capacity as long as social distancing measures were in place. There was no state-imposed limit on the size of social gatherings. Nicknamed COVID Kim by her critics, Reynolds changed course in mid-November in the face of surging cases and hospitalizations requiring masks. Illinois clamped down earlier and harder, instituting a mask mandate at the end of April. Movie theaters opened in Iowa before those in Illinois. Iowa never closed its golf courses when neighboring states like Illinois did. For Illinois businesses, the gap between the two states' regulations has been crushing, said Paul Rumler, the president of the Quad Cities Chamber. Tensions between Washington and Idaho over their divergent responses to the pandemic escalated in October. As the count of COVID-19 cases climbed, the board of the Panhandle Health District in Idaho voted 4-3 to rescind the mask order it had imposed on Kootenai County 3 months before. Officials in Washington were stunned. Inslee, the governor, refused to rule out restrictions on border traffic. The move by the health board came amid growing resistance in the state to mandatory public health measures to control the virus and a skepticism that COVID-19 was even real. A group of Idaho politicians, including Lieutenant Governor Janice McGichin, appeared in a video in October urging the state to limit restrictions. Sitting in a truck with an American flag draped over the side, McGichin placed a gun over a Bible. We recognize that all of us by nature are free and equal and have certain inalienable rights, she said. A legislator in the video said the pandemic may or may not be occurring.
Around the world with reporters. During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the President to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leadership in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up, and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers.
Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Mr.
protest in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel.